Computing bailouts is certainly an outgrowth of the mathematics department, which grew from that first hiring in 1897. When Bell Labs was formally founded in 1925, what it had been was the engineering department of Western Electric. When it was formally founded in 1925, almost from the beginning, there was a math department with Martin Fry as department head. And if you look at some of Fry's work, it turns out that he was fussing around in 1929 with trying to discover information here. It didn't actually gel until 20 years later with Shannon. Of course, most of the mathematics at that time was continuous. One was interested in analyzing circuits and propagation. And indeed, this is what led to the growth of computing in the laboratories. The computations could not all be done symbolically. There were not closed form solutions. There was lots of numerical computation done. There was the math department had a fair stable of computers, which in those days meant people, and computer systems. And in the late 30s, George Stivitz had an idea that some of the work that they were doing on hand calculators might be automated by using some of the equipment that that the Bell system was installing in central offices, namely relay circuits. And he went home, and on his kitchen table, he built out of relays a binary arithmetic circuit. He decided that binary was really the right way to compute. However, when he finally came to build some equipment, he determined that binary to decimal conversion and decimal to binary conversion was a drag. He didn't want to put it in the equipment. And so he finally built in 1939 a relay calculator that worked in decimal. And it worked in complex arithmetic. Do you have a hand calculator now that does complex arithmetic? 10-digit, I believe, complex computations as subtract, multiply, divide. The I.O. equipment was teletypes, so essentially all the stuff to make such machines out of was there. Since the I.O. was teletypes, it could be remotely accessed, and there were in fact four stations in the West Street Laboratories of Bell Labs. West Street is down on the west side of Manhattan. I had the good fortune to work there one summer, right next to a district where you're likely to get bowled over by rolling beeves hanging from racks or tumbling cabbages. It's on the building is still there. It's called West Beth Apartments. It's now an artist colony. Anyway, in West Street, there were four separate remote stations from which the complex calculator could be accessed. It was not timeshare. You actually reserved your time on the machine, and only one of the four terminals worked at a time. In 1940, this machine was shown off to the world at the AMS annual convention, which happened to be held in Hanover, Dartmouth that year. and mathematicians could wonder at remote computing, doing computation on an electromechanical calculator at 300 miles away. Stibitz went on from there to make a whole series of relay machines. Many of them were made for the government during the war. They were numbered. They were named imaginatively Mark 1 through Mark 6. None of them. I have read some of his patents. They're kind of fun. What he has a patent on conditional transfer. And how do you do a conditional transfer? Well, these gadgets were, the relay calculator was run from your fingers. I mean, the complex calculator. The later calculators, of course, if your fingers were in teletype, you could perfectly well feed and paper tape them because that was standard. That was standard practice. And these later machines were intended really to be run more for paper tape. And the conditional transfer was this. You have two teletypes. And there's a code that says time to read from the other teletype. Loops were, of course, easy to do. These machines never got to the point of having stored programs. But they got quite big. I saw one of them was here in 1954, and I did see it behind glass. And if you've ever seen these machines in the, there's one in the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, and there's one in the Science Museum in San Jose. You know, these machines that drop balls, that go wandering, sliding around and turning paddle wheels and ringing bells and who knows what. Kind of looked like that. It's a very quiet room with just a little clicking of relays, which is what a central office used to be like. It was the one air-conditioned room in Murray Hill, I think. This machine ran the Mark 6, well, I think that was the Mark 1. Mark 6 actually went to added. This machine ran for a good number of years, probably 6, 8. And it is said that it never made an undetected error. what that means is that it never made an error that it did not diagnose itself and stop. Relay technology was very, very defensive. The telephone switching system had to work and was full of self-checking, and so were the calculators. So were the calculators that it's made. The arithmetic was done in by quinary, a two out of five representation for decimal integers. And if there weren't exactly two out of five relays activated, it would stop. This machine ran unattended over the weekends. People would bring their tapes in, and an operator would paste everybody's tapes together. But there was a beginning of job code on the tape. If the machine, and there was also a time. If the machine ran out of time, it automatically stopped and went to the next job. If the machine caught itself in error, it backed up to the current job and tried it again. I would load this machine on Friday night, and on Monday morning, all
outbound things. All the entries will be available on outbound things.
Yeah, they were using a different representation for rooms and conditional fire.
Loops were done actually by, they would run back and forth across the tape now on this issue. Then came the transistor, 48. And at Whippany, they actually had a transistorized computer, which was a respectable mini computer, a box about this big, running in 1954. It ran from 1954 to 1956 solidly as a test run. The notion was that this computer might fly in an airplane. And during that 2-year test run, one diode failed. In 1957, this machine called Tradic did in fact fly an airplane, but to the best of my knowledge, it didn't turn into, that machine was a demonstration machine, it didn't turn into a production machine. About that time, we started buying commercial machines, and it's wonderful to think about the set of different architectures that existed at that time. The first machine we got was called the CPC from IBM. And all it was a big accounting machine with a very special plug board on the side that provided an interpreter for doing 10-digit decimal arithmetic, including opcodes for trig functions and square root. It was also not a computer as we know it today because it wasn't stored programming. It had 24 memory locations, as I recall. And it took its program instead of from tapes, from cards. This was not a total advantage. The tape did get into trouble if you dropped it on the floor. The CPC, the operator would stand in front of it, and there you would go through loops by taking cards out of it. You took human intervention. You take cards out of the output of the card reader and put them in the pocket. I actually ran some programs on the CPC before I came here. It's the kind of thing you can be nostalgic about, but it wasn't actually. The next machine was a 650, IBM 650, and here the main memory. This was a stored program with the main memory being on the memory being on drum. And there was no operating system for it. It came with a manual. This is what the machine does. And Mike Wolanis made an interpreter called the L1 interpreter for this machine. So you could actually program in the manual tells you how to program in binary. L1 allowed you to give something like 10 for add and 9 for subtract. You program decimal instead. And of course, that machine required interesting optimization because it was a nice thing if the next program step were stored somewhere. Each program step had the address of the following step in it. And you would try to locate them around the drum so that minimize latency. So there were all kinds of optimizers around. I don't think the labs made them, but they certainly imported them. The biggest one was called SOAP. From Carnegie Mellon. That machine didn't last very long. Fortunately, a machine that with core memory came out from IBM in 56 to 704. Bell Labs is a little slow in getting one. Came in 58. Again, the machine came without an operating system. In fact, but it did have Fortran, which really changed the world. It suddenly made it easy to make improvements. But the way Fortran came from IBM, it came with a thing called the Fortran Stop Book. This was a list of what happened. A diagnostic was to execute the halt instruction. The operator would go read the panel lights and discover where the machine had stopped. You would then go look up in the stock book what that meant. Bell Labs, with George Mealy and Glenn Hanson, made an operating system, and one of the things they did was to bring the stop book to Eel. They replaced, they took the compiler, replaced all the stop instructions with jumps to somewhere. Introduced and allowed the program, instead of stopping, to go on to the next job. By the time I arrived at Bell Labs in 1958, this thing was running nicely. Bell Labs would continue to be a major player in operating systems. This was called BSIS. BE was the share abbreviation for Bell Labs. Each company that belonged to Share had it, which was the IBM Users Group, had a two-letter abbreviation. It's hard to imagine taking all computer users down to doing two-letter abbreviations. BSIS went through many generations up to BSIS 5, I believe. Each book with innovations. IBM delivered a machine, the 7090, in 1960. This machine had interrupts in it, what IBM did. And what BSIS did, and that sent IBM back to the drawing board to make it work. It didn't have memory protection either. our people actually got IBM to put memory protection in the 7090 so that one could leave the operating system resident in the presence of a wild program. An idea that the PC didn't discover till last year or something like that. Big players then. Dick Hammack, a name that I'm sure everybody knows, was sort of the numerical analysis guru, and a seer, and he liked to make outrageous predictions. He predicted in 1960 that half of Bell Labs was going to be busy doing something with computers eventually. That's a little exaggerated. So, as I said in the abstract of this talk, he was wrong. Half was a gross underestimate. Dick Hammack retired 20 years ago, and just this June, he completed his full 20 years term in the Navy, which entitles him again to retire from the Naval Postgraduate Institute in Monterey. Stibitz, incidentally, died within the last, I think within the last year. He was doing medical instrumentation at Dartmouth Central near the end. Various problems intrigued. Besides the numerical problems, which in fact were stock and trade, and were the real justification for my until. Until at least the 70s, I would say. But some non-numerical problems had begun to tickle the palate of the math department. Even G.A. Campbell got interested in graph theory. The reason being, he wanted to think of all the possible ways you could take the three wires and the various parts of the telephone and connect them together and try permutations to see what you could do about reducing side tone by putting things into the various parts of the circuit. You devise every possible way of connecting the telephone. And that was sort of the beginning of quantum intelligence. John Reardon, mathematician, parlayed that into a major subject. And two problems have intrigued, which are now deemed as computing problems, have intrigued the math department for a very long time. And those are the minimum span tree problem, and the wonderfully Joe Kruskal this morning. and in the 50s, Bob Prim and Kruskal, I don't think went to the labs at that point. He invented algorithms for minimum spanning tree. Somehow or other, computer scientists usually learn these algorithms. One of the two was Dijkstra's algorithm, but he was a late. Another pet was traveling salesman. There's been a long list of people at Bell Labs that played to that. Shen Lin and Brian Graham and David Johnson and Douglas Moore. And then another problem is the Steiner minimum spanning tree, where you're allowed to add points to the graph. Every one of these problems actually had a justification in telephone billing. One jurisdiction or another would specify that the way you bill for a private line network was in one jurisdiction by the minimum spanning tree, in another jurisdiction by the traveling salesman group. Envy completeness wasn't a word in the vocabulary of the And the Steiner problem came up because customers discovered they could beat the system by inventing offices in the middle of Tennessee that had nothing to do with their business, but they could put the office at a Steiner point and reduce their phone bill by adding to what the service that the Bell system had to give. So all of these problems actually have some justification in billing besides being fun. Come the 60s, we actually started to hire people for computing per se. I was perhaps the third person who was hired with a PhD to help take care of the computers. And I'm told that the then director, then head of the math department, Henry Bowden, had said to his people, "Yeah, you can hire this guy instead of a real mathematician." But what's he been doing in 5 years? nevertheless, we started hiring for real in about 67. computer science got split off from the math department, and I had the good fortune to move to my office, so I've been here ever since then. Computing began to make get a personality of its own. One of the interesting people that came to Lab for a while was Hao Wang. Is his name well known? Hao Wang is a philosopher and logician. And we got a letter from him in England out of the blue saying, hey, you know, can I come and use your computers? I have an idea about theorem improving. And there was theorem improving in the air in the late 50s, and it was mostly pretty thin stuff. Obvious that the methods being proposed wouldn't possibly do anything more difficult than solving technical problems by enumeration. Wang had a notion that he could mechanically prove theorems in the style of Whitehead and Russell's great treatise, the Principia Mathematica of the early part of the century. He came here, learned how to program in machine language, and took all of Volume 1 of Principia Mathematica. If you've ever hefted Principia, that's about all it's good for. It's a real good war stop. It's really good. But it's theorem after theorem after theorem in propositional calculus. And of course, there's a decision procedure for propositional calculus. He was proving them more in the style of the Whitehead and Russell. And when he finally got them all coded and put them into the computer, he proved the entire contents of his immense book in 8 minutes. This was actually a new topic. Also, that was the beginning of formal language theory. And we hired people like Alejo Kepal, who kind of probed around every possible model of grammar and syntax and all of the things that are now in the standard standard undergraduate curriculum were pretty well nailed down on syntax and finite state machines and so on. We're pretty well nailed down. Speaking of finite state machines, in the 50s, both Mealy and Moore, who have the two of the well-known models of finite state machines, were here. During the 60s, we undertook an enormous development project in the guise of research, which was MOBIUS. The notion of this of MOBIUS was computing was the public utility of the future. Machines were very expensive, and indeed, like you don't own your own electric generator, you have to go out to the power company. Generation point. And it was seen that this was a good way to do computing, time sharing. And it was also recognized that shared data was a very good thing. MIT pioneered this, and Bell Labs joined in on the MOBIUS project. And this occupied 5 years of system programming effort. And so Bell Labs pulled out. Because it turned out that MOBIUS was too ambitious for the hardware at the time. It also, with 80 people on it, was not exactly a research project. But that led to various people who were on the project and particularly Ken Thompson,
right there,
to think about how to, and Dennis Ritchie and Red Kennedy were in on this, to think about how you might make it up a pleasant operating system with a little less resources. And Ken found that, this is a story that's often been told, so I won't go into very much of you each year. Ken found an old machine and cast off in the corner, 87, and put up this little operating system on it. And we had immense GE635 available at the comp center at the time, and I remember as a department head muscling in to use this little computer to be, get to be Unix's first user, customer, because it was so much pleasanter to use this tiny machine than it was to use the big and capable machine by the comp center. And of course, the rest of the story is known to everybody that has affected all college campuses in the country. Along with the operating system work, there's been a fair amount of language work done at Bell Labs. Often curious, offbeat languages. One of my favorites is called Bloody. B-L-O-D-I. The block diagram compiler by Kelly and Musatsky. Perhaps the most interesting early uses of computers and most unexpected, in the sense of being unexpected, were those that came from the acoustics research department. And the Bloody compiler was invented in the acoustic research department for doing digital simulations of sample data systems. And a sample data system is more than DSPs are classic sample data systems, where instead of passing analog signals around, you pass around streams of numerical values. And Bloody allowed you to say, here's a delay unit, here's an amplifier, here's an adder, the standard piece parts for a sample data system. And each one was described on a card and with description of what it's wired to. It was then compiled into one enormous single straight line loop for one time step. Of course, you had to rearrange the code because one part of the loop would feed up the sample data system would feed another. You'd rearrange the code and produce really very efficient 7090 code for simulating these sample data systems. And it's by and large from that time forward, the acoustics department, the research department, stopped making hardware. And it was much easier to do signal processing visually than previous ways of doing that. Bloody had an interesting property. It's the only programming language I know where, or this is not my original observation, but Sosky said, where you can take the deck of cards, throw it up the stairs, and pick them up at the bottom of the stairs and feed it to the computer again and get the same program out. Bloody had two, aside from syntax diagnostics, it did have one diagnostic when it would fail to compile, and that was somewhere in your system is a loop that consists of all delays or no delays, or has no delays. And so, and you can imagine how they came about. Another interesting programming language of the 60s was Ken Moulton's Beeflings. This was for making movies. Movies on something with resolution kind of comparable to 640 by 480. Really, really coarse. And the programming notion in here was bugs. You put onto your grid a bunch of bugs, and each bug carried along some data as baggage, little data structure, and you would do things like cellular automata operations. You could program it, or you could kind of let it go by itself. If this bug is next to, if a red bug is next to a blue bug, then it turns into a green bug on the following step, and so on. He and Lillian Schwartz made some interesting abstract movies at the time. They also did some interesting picture processing. There was one wonderful picture of reclining Newton, something about the size of that blackboard over there. All made of pixels about a half inch high, each with a different little picture in it, picked out for their density. So if you looked at it close up, it consisted of pickaxes and candles and dogs. And if you looked at it far enough away, it was a reclining Newton. And that picture got a lot of play all around the country. What? Was that Harmon?
Harmon.
Harmon was also an interesting character. He did more than pictures. Glad you reminded me of it. I had it written down. Harmon was a guy who, among other things, used the block diagram compiler for writing handwriting recognition programs. I never did understand how this scheme worked. And in fact, I guess it didn't work too well. it didn't work, but it was an absolutely immense sample-level circuit for doing handwriting. Harman's most famous work was trying to estimate the information content in face. And every one of these pictures, which are a cliche now, they show a face digitized very coarsely. Go back to Harman's first experiment, psychological experiments, where he tried to find out how many bits of picture he needed to make the face recognizable. And he went around and digitized about 256 faces from Bell Labs and did real psychological experiments asking which faces were could be distinguished from other ones. I had the good fortune to have one of the most distinguishable faces. And consequently, you'll find me in freshman psychology texts. No fault of my own. Another thing going on in the 60s was the halting beginning here of interactive computing. And again, the credit has to go to the Acoustic Research Department. For good and sufficient reason, they wanted to be able to feed signals into the machine and look at them and get them back out. And they bought yet another weird architecture machine called the Packard Bell 250. Where the memory elements were mercury delay lines.
Packard Bell?
What?
Packard Bell?
Packard Bell. Same one that makes PCs today.
Same dude.
And they hung this off of the Contractor 7090 and put in a scheme for quickly shipping jobs into the job stream on the 7090. And Packard Bell was the real-time terminal you could play with and repair stuff. They would quick ship stuff off the 7090, get it back, and you could play. From that grew some graphics machines also, built by Dominiki and all. And it was one of the old graphics machines, in fact, the pen picked up to make to build Unisign. Another thing that went on in the acoustics department was synthetic speech and music. Max Matthews, who is the director of the department, has long been interested in computer music. In fact, since retirement, he spent a lot of time with Pierre Boulez in Paris at a wonderful institute with lots of money for simply for making synthetic music. He had a language called Music 5. Synthetic speech, or first of all, simply speech, simply speech processing, was pioneered particularly by John Kelly. And I remember my first contact with speech processing. It was customary for computer operators, for the benefit of computer operators, to put a loudspeaker on the low bit of some register in the machine. And normally the operator would just hear kind of white noise. But if you got into a loop, suddenly the machine would scream. And this signal could be used for the operator to say, oh, the machine's in the loop, go stop it, go to the next job. I remember feeding them that Ackerman's function routine once. They thought they were right. It was a silly loop. But anyway, one day the operators were killed. The machine started saying, "Out of the loop, help! Out of the loop." In a broad Texas accent, which was the recorded voice of John Kelly. From the beginnings of from there, Kelly went on to do some speech synthesis, and of course, there's been a lot more speech synthesis work done since by folks like Cecil Coker, Joe Olive, they produced a record, which unfortunately I can't play because records are not modern anymore. And everybody got one in the Bell Labs record, which is a magazine. I think it was a record from the acoustics department. And with both speech and music, and one very famous combination where the computer played and sang, The Bicycle Built for Two. At the same time as all this stuff is going on here, needless to say, computing is going on in the rest of the labs. It was about the early 60s when the math department lost its monopoly on computing machines, and other people started buying them too. But for switching, the first experiments with switching computers went operational in around 1960. They had been planned for several years prior to that. Essentially, as soon as the transistor was invented,
the making of electronic rather than electromechanical switching machines was anticipated. And part of the saga of the switching machines is cheap memory. These machines had enormous memories, thousands of words. And it was said that the present worth of each word of memory that programmers say across the Bell system was something like $11. And it was worthwhile to struggle to save that. Also, programs were permanent. You were going to load up the switching machine with a switching program, and that was going to run. You didn't change it every minute or two. And it should be cheaper to put it in read-only memory than in core memory. And there was a whole series of wild read-only memories, both tried and built. The first experimental ESSIS system had a thing called the Flying Spot Store, which was large photographic plates with bits on them and CRTs reading projecting on the plates, and you would detect underneath the photodetector whether the bit was set or not. That was the program store of ESSIS. The program store of the first ESS system consisted of twisters, which I actually am not sure I understand to this day, but they consist of an iron wire with a copper wire wrapped around them and vice versa. There were also experiments with an IC type memory called the waffle iron. And then there was a period when magnetic bubbles were all the rage. As far as I know, although microelectronics made a lot of memory, most of the memory work at Bell Labs has not had much effect. Nice tries, though. Another thing that folks tried to work on, that folks began to work on, was the application. And of course, right from the start, the application of computers to data processing. When you own equipment scattered through every street in the country, and you have 100 million customers, and you have bills for 100 million transactions a day, there's really some big data processing going on. And indeed, in the early 60s, AT&T was thinking of making its own data processing computers solely for billing. Somehow, they pulled out of that and gave all their technology to IBM. And one piece of that technology went into use in high-end equipment. It was called tractor tapes. Inch-wide magnetic tapes that were used for a while. But by and large, although Bell Labs has participated until fairly recently in data processing in quite a big way, AT&T never really quite trusted the labs to do it right.
because here is where the money is. I can recall one occasion when, during a strike, temporary employees, fill-in employees, like from the laboratories and so on, lost a day's billing day in Chicago. And that was $1 million. That's generally speaking, the money people have not, did not until fairly recently, trust Bell Labs to get their money, even though they trusted Labs very well to make extremely reliable computing equipment switches. The downtime on switches is still spectacular by any industry standards. The design for the first ones was 2 hours down in 40 years, and the design was bad. Hot, great emphasis on reliability and redundancy. Testing. Another branch of computing was for the government. The whole Whippany Laboratories, I can't see the clock. Is it quarter after or is it half past?
25
was at Whippany, where we took on contracts for the government, particularly in during the computing era. Anti-missile defense, and underwater sound. Missile defense was a very impressive undertaking. It was about in the 63 time frame when it was estimated the amount of computation to do a reasonable job of tracking incoming missiles would be 30 million floating point operations a second. In the day of the parade, that doesn't sound like a great lot, but it's more than your high end PC. And the machines were supposed to be reliable. They designed machines that would be a 12 processor multiprocessor to no specs. Enormously rugged, 1 watt transistors. This thing in real life performed remarkably well. There were 65 missile shots tests across the Pacific Ocean, the flag line, and Rita Cherry here actually sat there waiting for them to come in. Yeah. And only a half dozen of them really failed. As a measure of the interest in reliability, one of them failed apparently due to processor error. Two people were assigned to look at the dumps, enormous amounts of telemetry and logging information were taken during these tests, which are truly expensive. Two people were assigned to look at the dumps. A year later, they had not found the trouble. The team was beefed up. They finally decided that there was a race condition in one circuit. They then realized that this particular kind of race condition had not been tested for in all the simulations. They went back and simulated the entire hardware system to see if there's a remote possibility for any similar cases. Found 12 of them and changed the hardware. But to spend over a year looking for a bug is a sign of what reliability meant. Since I'm coming up on the end of an hour, I want to go on and on and on. But I think I'd like to I think I'd like to end up by mentioning a few of the programs that have been written at Bell Labs that I think are the most surprising. Of course, there are lots of grant programs. I already mentioned the block diagram. Another really remarkable piece of work was EQN, the equation typesetting, which has been imitated since by Larry Chimery and Brian Kernahan. Just the notion of taking an auditory syntax, the way people talk about equations, but only talk. This was not borrowed from any written notation before. Getting the auditory one down on paper, it was a very successful and surprising another of my favorites, and again we're in charge of this one with Bob Marks, was Typo. This was a program for finding spelling errors. He didn't know the first thing about spelling. He would read a document, measure its statistics, and print out in the words of the document in increasing order of what it thought the likelihood of that word having come from the same statistical source as the document. The words that did not come from the statistical source of the document were likely to be typos. And now I mean typos as distinct from spelling errors, where you actually hit the wrong key. Those tend to be off the wall, whereas phonetic spelling errors are never fine. It's phonetically. And this worked remarkably well. spelling and typing errors would come right up to the top of the list. Really, really deep program. Another one of my favorites was by Brenda Baker, which took Fortran programs and converted them into a structured programming language called RATFORM, which was Fortran with C syntax. And but this seemed like a possible undertaking. But, just like something you do by the seat of the pants and you get something out of it. And in fact, folks at Lockheed have done things like that before. But Brenda managed to find theorems. She said there's really only one form of, there's a canonical form into which you can structure a Fortran program. And she did this. You took your Fortran program, completely matched it, put it out perhaps in almost certainly a different order than it was your Fortran, where it was connected by go-tos, without any go-tos. And the really remarkable thing was that authors of the program, who clearly knew the way they wrote it in the first place, preferred it after it had been rearranged by the render. I was astonished at the outcome of that project. Another first that happened around here was by Fred Grant, who got interested in computer security. And one day he decided he would make a program for sniffing the security arrangements on a computer. As a service, not at Fred would never do anything crooked. this particular program did a remarkable job and founded a whole minor industry within the company. A whole department was set up to take this idea and parlay it. And indeed, ever since there has been some improvement in the way computer centers are managed, at least until we got Berkeley units. And the last interesting program that I mentioned is one by Ken Church. He was dealing with text processing has always been a continuing lifeline of the research. And in some sense, it has an application in our business because we're handling speech, for instance. But he got into consulting with the department in North Carolina that has to translate manuals. There are millions of pages of manuals in the old system and its successors. And ever since we've gone global, maybe these things have to get translated. To help in this, it was making tools which would put up on a screen, grab to the screen quickly a piece of text and its translation. Because a translator often needs to, particularly a technical text, wants to know, oh, how was this? The last time we mentioned this word, how was it translated? You don't want to be creative in translating technical. You would like to be able to go back into the archives and pull up examples of translated text. And the neat thing here is the idea for how do you align texts in two languages. You've got the original, you've got the translated one. How do you bring up on the screen the two sentences that go together? And the following scan worked beautifully. Simply, this is on Western language. Simply, look for common four-letter tetragrams, four-letter combinations between the two, and as best as you can, line them up as nearly linearly with the length of the two texts as possible. And this very simple idea works like stone. Something for nothing. I like that. The last thing is one slogan that sort of got started in use and is just rife in the industry now: software tool. We were making software tools in Unix, before we knew we were, just like the Molière character who was amazed at discovering that he could be prose all his life. But then Kernahan and Plowder came along and christened what was going on. Making simple, generally useful, and compositional programs to do one thing and do it well and them fit together. And they call this software tools. They wrote a book, and this notion now is just abroad in the industry. It really did all begin up in a little attic room or even sack. Oh, I forgot to, I haven't used any slides. I wrote some, but I don't like looking at bullets, and you wouldn't either. And I forgot to show you the one exhibit I brought, which I borrowed from Bob Kirshen. When Bell Labs was founded, it had, of course, some calculating machines, and it had one wonderful computer. This. That was bought in 1918. There's almost no other computing equipment from any time prior to 10 years ago. It still exists in Bell Labs. This is an Intergraph. It has two styluses. You trace a curve on a piece of paper with one stylus, and the other stylus draws the index. And there was somebody in the math department who gave his service to the whole company about 24 hours per grade time, calculating integrals. Our recent vice president, Arnold Penzias, actually did. He calculated integrals different background. And he had a chemical balance. He cut the curves on the paper and weighed. This was bought in 1918, so it's 80 years old. It used to be shiny metal at the time. It's a little bit rusty now, but it still works. Well, that's a once-over, likely, of a whole lot of things that have gone out of Bell Labs, which is just such a fun place that when, I said, well, we go on and on. If you're interested, there actually is a history book. This is only one of about six volumes. This is the one that it has, the mathematical computer sciences, the kind of things that I've mostly talked about here. A few people have copies of them. For some reason, the AT&T publishing house thinks that because of history, they're obsolete and they stop printing. Thank you. That's all.